Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work Plus, specifically the Comics Corner of Friends from Work Plus, hosted by me, Robbie Earle, and by her, Candace Earle.
Hey, Robbie.
Welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
We are nearing the end of our journey here through Spider-Man. Last time we talked about Hawkeye, taking a little break. Now we're back closing this thread off soon ahead of Spider-Man No Way Home, which comes out this week. Candace, are you excited?
I am excited. I'm experiencing a little FOMO because I know that I'm not going to get to see it before everyone else like you.
Yeah.
But you know what? Life gives you lemons.
You know, it's interesting for all those that are curious about the behind the scenes of this. One might expect that Marvel, with their history of being pretty locked down with spoilers, would be more intense about the screenings. But I have found that Sony, not just, by the way, for No Way Home, because I know No Way Home is a big one, so you might expect that, but even like for Venom, they do not offer the plus ones that Marvel does.
Because, you know, we're all just salivating to see more Venom.
Right. hey, they're going to keep making them.
It's true.
Speaking of, this week, Venom is one of the many characters we're going to get to spend a little bit of time with.
Man, you took no prisoners this week. This is so much reading.
I know.
Give me more time.
Well, we're sprinting to the finish here. We actually are going to try to get one more episode out soon. I would recommend, just as a housekeeping note, that if you're listening to this and you're already ready to move on to your next comics batch, I would really encourage you to read what we posted on the Slack and on our Twitter, which is the final reading order. We are finishing up now what I kind of think of as our essential Spider-Man journey that has been modeled largely after what's shown up in all of the films that Kyle and I have been walking through. And that finally, we've gotten there here now as we finish off with Venom. I think he's the final villain that we had to cover. But the last batch of comics is specifically pulled from what I think and what I've seen others think might be pulled most directly for No Way Home. So it's very Doctor Strange heavy. There are a couple scenes that already just from the trailer are clearly pulled straight from these comics. On our last episode on the main feed with Dan Gavazdin, after that episode was over, he and I talked a little bit and I was kind of validated in my reading choices because he was thinking that they're pulling from some of the same issues. So even if you don't get a chance to listen to our episode covering that before you see the movie, I would highly recommend that you take a chance to peruse those issues. And then I think either towards the tail end of this week or sometime soon, we will be getting our final episode out to kind of coincide with that.
Right. You know, I love Doctor Strange.
I think you're going to enjoy, and those are all, every comic we're reading in the last batch came out after the year 2000, so I think that will make a lot of difference.
The sweet release. I will say, I noticed that we left the Stan Lee era in this last batch.
Yeah, about midway through, Stan drops off.
And when I noticed the shift, I felt a little guilty for how I've been, you know, talking about him.
You missed the man.
I missed the man in so far as that it gets way less kooky moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I've enjoyed that.
Hey, look, you don't know what you have until he's gone.
I know. And so, well, this is actually, I didn't mean for this to go this way, but this is where I want to start a bit of an apology tour. Is that okay?
Wow. Yeah, please.
So I would like to apologize for how I've talked about Stanley, because as much as he is very long-winded, I am also someone that likes to hear myself talk. So I can understand where he's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
My second apology is to Jeremy Renner. Because apparently I was, quote unquote, too mean in the last Hawkeye episode. So, Jeremy, if you're out there and if you hear this, it is, I wanted to say it was, it had nothing against him, but it's like only against him. So, I'm still working on that apology.
Hey, and you are still working your way through the Hawkeye series, which may change your view some.
It's true. So I've seen the first two episodes and I'm really enjoying it. And I'll save that for another time.
Which, by the way, this episode is releasing in the middle of our Hawkeye/Spider-Man No Way Home mega week. So there's a lot of Hawkeye stuff happening as well. So just take a week off of work and just consume Friends from Work content, because there's enough of it.
I will be transparent and say that to catch up on this week's reading about romances, I did take Friday afternoon off and just read these comics.
As you should.
So I don't know if other people have that availability, but I figured it out and I'm not proud of it, but
I've just been staying up till 3 a.m. That's my secret.
Yeah, I can't do that. So
the reason we wanted to go down this route is because not necessarily just No Way Home, although I think that there is some Spider-Man MJ stuff that we're going to be getting there. But again, as we've kind of been taking a tour through all the movies, the Spider-Man love interest is a really big part of that character in a way that, as you look through like the rest of the MCU, for instance, it's not as pivotal, but like all the Raimi films really center on him and Mary Jane. The Mark Webb ones really center on him and Gwen Stacy. And Homecoming looks at Liz, who we had already covered. But then Far From Home is again about Peter trying to figure out how to express himself to Mary Jane. So I feel like as we're trying to like kind of figure out the DNA of Spider-Man and like get a different perspective on these films, it's really important to see how pivotal that's been in his comic history as well.
And you know, I love a rom-com, right. So I was particularly invested this week.
Varies between rom-com and soap opera, maybe leaning more heavily towards the latter.
And just general uncomfortableness.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the right way to say that, but I have a lot of thoughts.
Well, yeah, let's jump in. I was thinking with this one this week, as is my wont, we can just kind of go through the blocks that we discussed, starting with the first batch, which was Amazing Spider-Man number 41 through number 43.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple things I wanted to ask you about here, because there are a couple reasons why this is a significant group of issues. The most obvious one I'll say for last. First, and just keeping it to this point in the timeline before we move forward, how did you feel about the Rhino?
I had a lot of sympathy towards the Rhino.
Wow.
So I have a note in my phone that whenever I'm reading these and I have a thought, like I don't want to forget about it. So I had to just kind of make some quick note about it. And I find his origin story very compelling. Uh-huh. I also find it very sad because he seems like a very innocent person that kind of just needs the money and is taken advantage of by the government.
Right.
On that note, and this is going to be an interesting Venn diagram of people that understand this reference, but the moment when the Rhino is shedding his skin, you know what I'm going to say?
Is this a Narnia reference?
Yes.
Yeah.
I kind of got this whole, I think this is where my sympathy is coming from, is that it made me think of Eustace. If you've read the Chronicles of Narnia, when Eustace has the dragon scales on him and they start pulling them off, which is like a metaphor for, you know,
ego in some ways.
Yeah. And watching the rhino kind of shed his skin that's kind of been stuck to him that he can't get off, and then finally kind of turns back into a human.
Right.
Was something that I found pretty profound.
Yeah. No, I think, and yeah, it gets him into this like vulnerable state. That's a good, wow. I did not expect you to have the compassionate take towards the rhino. I like that.
You know, sometimes you're just down on your luck and you turn into a rhino.
For those counting, the rhino is our next to last villain that we haven't covered yet that appears, albeit briefly, in The Amazing Spider-Man 2, played by, of all people, Paul Giamatti.
Interesting.
Yep.
So you've had those movies on in the house, and I've kind of just been generally around and not paying that much attention. But I walked in the other day, and I was like, is that Paul Giamatti? And you were just like, you just laughed and didn't really give me much context. I didn't realize that he was playing the rhino. That's interesting.
Yeah, strange
call. I am so confused at the directions that some of these movies have taken.
Yeah.
Insofar as that whenever I've read The Lizard or when I've read The Rhino.
Or Electro even.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that we could use as an example. But I just wouldn't take them the way that these film studios have chosen to take them.
Right.
So I that's opening up a can of worms, but Paul Giamatti in a robotic rhino suit is not how I would necessarily see this.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, though. And the reason I lump Electro into that is I think that that was a weakness of those Mark Webb films, especially. Like, I do think the Raimi films did a decent job with Green Goblin, Doc Ock. Sandman and Venom were probably, they could be lumped in the poor adaptation category as well. But then the MCU ones have done a fantastic job with the Vulture and Mysterio. But
well, that's getting off track because we're not here to talk about the rhino.
You're right.
We're here to talk about love.
Well, so that's my second question I had before we get again to the main event here. How are you feeling at this particular stage as it's progressing about Gwen Stacy and Peter's sort of somewhat burgeoning relationship?
You know, I'm putting myself into a college kid's mindset.
Uh-huh.
For this answer, I think that Peter is kind of dumb, especially when it comes to romances.
Sure.
And I'm giving him a little bit of grace there because he just seems maybe inexperienced and doesn't really know how to juggle multiple emotions at one time.
Uh-huh.
But he's treating this woman terribly.
He
keeps blowing her off. I don't want to objectify women, even if they're in comics, but I will say that I think Gwen Stacy is beautiful, and for him to just kind of brush her off over and over is such a waste.
Yeah. No, it's true. I think it's funny how all the, well, I believe is, yeah, it is 41 is the first time he's even like, or maybe 42 when he's like, oh man,
he's like, she might like me. And I'm like,
right.
Are you not picking up on any of these cues? She invites you. You're so lame. And she invites you to every party.
Well, this is also like, this is such just an interesting transition. Like, we talked about Romita coming on and we got a little bit of that with those final Green Goblin issues, but we really get that here. Like, we talked in our episode with Dan about how it really transforms the characters. Because, and that's what I think you see happening with Peter being like, oh, wow, Gwen Stacy. It's like Romita is suddenly like, he's moving everybody forward to be like, let's make everyone not so grumpy and angry and angsty and make people like actually kind of have fun and like each other. And so he has Peter being like, oh, wow, this really beautiful woman that's into me. That sounds interesting. I'm going to like actually care about that instead of just like brood in the shadows in my aunt's house all the time.
Right. There, someone made a really funny comment in the Slack about how they were going to be sad that Aunt May, as we progress in this storyline, how Aunt May isn't going to be dunking on Peter for being frail all the time. And this codependent relationship with Aunt May and Peter is going to send me to my grave. I'm just so annoyed because they're both like, they both talk about each other the same way. where right. she's like, oh, this poor Peter, this grown man that is living in my house, if I don't feed him, he's going to die, or he's so frail, he's going to get sick. And he's saying the same thing about her, but uh-huh. they both want out of the relationship.
When they get out. It's just so
funny to me, because he's like, man, I'm a grown man that wants an apartment, but my poor Aunt May, and she's like, just let me move in with my friend. It just drives me insane.
That's funny. I do think that's another thing, though, right? Like, you see Romita trying to, and you can see how Stan gave him license. Like, he comes in and he's like, okay, we're going to make Peter hotter. We're going to make the people around Peter hotter. We're going to make everyone's personality better. We're going to give Peter a motorcycle. We're going to get him out of his aunt's house and, like, living in a place with a roommate. It's just like Romita came in and he was like, this is pathetic.
I really appreciate that, too. Like, I picture him walking into work day one and it's just like, got like a bottle of Windex and some Pledge and is like, all right, it's time to clean up around here.
But, you know, that's the thing. I said this on the Slack as I started reading through these. I do think, for me, these are probably the comics I read the most growing up, so I'm biased. But I think that this is kind of what I think of. Even though the Lee Ditko stuff is, like, that's where, like I've always said, a lot of the DNA is and the core of the character is born. This is when I feel like it really hits its stride in this era. Like, as you start to get not just the villains, but I think especially the interpersonal stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that, like, really takes over the book more. And the villains, like, whereas the villains were very much the forefront of the Ditko stuff, like, that's what I think marked that run, is they came up with so many different creative villains. Here, there are less of those that we cover, but I feel like the relationships that Peter has are so interesting that it's kind of okay to let the villains take a back seat for a bit.
Well, you say that, and I think they're just woven in differently. What I mean by that is J. Jonah Jameson's son coming back.
Right.
And that is a villain. I say that loosely.
Right.
But he's still woven into the inner workings of their relationships, mm-hmm. to where it's just more complex.
Right.
You're towing some different lines that you wouldn't necessarily have to address if you were just talking about a bad guy.
Right. No, that's a really good point.
Which, to that point, one thing that was just really funny to me is the solution to J. Jonah Jameson's son's problem was just to give him this big-ass suit.
Right. Well, and then I just thought it's funny that the solution to Jonah Jameson's son going kind of crazy and getting super strong is Peter just, like, shocks the hell out of him. And he's like, I knew that this would work. And I'm like, did you?
I just love that they're like, man, he's really strong. I guess we just have to make everything unbelievably heavy,
right,
so that he's less strong, I suppose. It was just a funny solution to me.
So that gets us into the last thing I wanted to talk about from this batch of issues, which we'll talk about with issue 43 as well, but especially the end of issue 42. I was telling you last time, that is one of the most famous panels of any comic ever. It's been duplicated and riffed on, like, countless times, but the face of Tiger, you just hit the jackpot scene, is maybe the most classic, like, example of this, the romance kind of taking front seat here in the Romita era.
Yeah.
So what did you think about our big MJ reveal finally?
I mean, I love, she's so much. This woman is insane.
She is actually kind of insane when you read these early issues.
Only in so far as that I respect her confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I wish that my opening line to you was that you just hit the jackpot. What I loved about it is that it ended the comic. Our cliffhanger was on this woman that they've been talking about for 40 issues.
Yeah, basically.
So it's really exciting to me that we're now finally getting into it. And also kind of funny that it's taken this long.
Right. And you know, it's like they set it up a little bit. Like Ditko had those scenes where her face is covered and Liz and Betty are like, holy cow, Peter's hanging out with this girl. And so you start to think she's either like really pretty or like a total freak of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's still like, I'm so glad that that moment was saved for Romita, because Romita is so good at drawing like pretty women that I think it comes across really well.
Is it far different from the number 300 annual Venom that we will talk about later? But
yes.
Okay. What I will also say, because I know that probably a lot of this discussion is going to be talking about the differences between Gwen Stacy and Mary Jane.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I respect about Mary Jane, and I think what makes her probably more compatible with Peter, is even at the beginning, if he cancels on her, she's very understanding. She doesn't take it personally.
Right.
And she doesn't know that he's Spider-Man yet. And so I think given who Peter is and his manic mannerisms, even though she is equally manic in other ways, it is kind of compatible to me.
No, I think that that's right. I think that, and that's something that Mary Jane in different ways always does throughout their relationship. And I think it's one of the reasons that Spider-Man comics readers love that relationship so much. And we'll talk about that a little bit more next time, because that's created a lot of drama and toxicity within the Spider-Man fan community. But it's because Mary Jane is so, she was kind of ahead of her time a little bit as a character, in that she wasn't the like, oh, but like Peter, I just like, you have to be here with me, and like super naggy and super like you said, codependent. Like she has her own life and her own, like she, it's like she doesn't just wait to get the opportunity to hang out with Peter. Like if he can't hang out with her, she's like, all right, that's fine. I've got like my own stuff going on.
Right.
And I think she's always like that, even like once they get into the marriage, like you see in some of the issues we read, she's like largely a fully formed, like interesting character. She's not defined as a love interest.
Right. Which is something that kind of even feels ahead of its time for when this was being written.
Right. And is sadly like not reflected as much in the Kirsten Dunst version.
No, not at all. But that character is horrible.
I know. That's what I'm saying. It's almost weird, like it's flipped. The Raimi films version of MJ is much more like the Gwen that we get here. And the Mark Webb films version of Gwen is much, played by Emma Stone, is much more like the Mary Jane that we get here. And I think that's part of why the relationship in those Mark Webb films really kind of stands above the others.
Right. Well, and I'll say I have really enjoyed the Tom Holland Spider-Man's MJ. And because I think what I like about her is that she is very much her own person. Mm-hmm. And she's, the way Zendaya plays MJ is that she's kind of confident in who she is, even though she's just kind of dark and weird, which is one thing I just love about that character.
Right.
The other thing that I wanted to add there, which we talked about this week and that I pointed out to you, is it's weird to me that Tom Holland's Spider-Man has not found his affinity for photography.
Yeah, because that's such a big part of these.
I mean, half the issue is Peter trying to get the shot.
Right.
But I guess J. Jonah Jameson isn't in the new movies either, so.
Not until now. Yeah, okay. I mean, well, because he showed up in the post-credit scene of Far From Home.
Mm-hmm.
And he is going to be in No Way Home. But no, that's a really, like, that's a huge part of, like, the Daily Bugle was a big part of the Ditko stuff, like we talked about. But it was largely Jameson, Betty, and Peter with a little bit of Frederick Foswell in there, who I don't think we talked about.
No, which I want. Who is that?
He's a reporter that in the early Ditko issues is found to have been like living a dual life as a crime boss.
That's right. That's right.
And so Peter, Spider-Man, winds up helping to apprehend him in a roundabout way, and he gets out of prison, and Jonah, and this is, that was sort of part of the turn that I think Romita also does a really good job with. Jonah rehires Foswell, and it's like part him, he like kind of touts it as like, oh, you know, I'm just doing this because it's like, it looks good. It makes me look good. But you kind of start to see that Jonah does have a soft spot and he is kind of compassionate. And that's like, whenever I talk about Ramita's version of the bugle, I feel like you get some stuff here where it's like you find out Jonah does have a certain level of integrity. Like Jonah does fight for civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
Like you meet Robbie Robertson and get their conversations. And it just really fleshes out the bugle too. And so, yeah, I think it makes me always wish that we like had that component.
I like that you say that because I don't know if this is a bold thing to say or not, but I really like what John Romita's done.
Yeah. No, I agree.
I think it's better.
I might think so too, which is hard to say because he's clearly like, he has the benefit of an established...
In hindsight.
Right.
So that, I think, leads into... Did you put number 50 in here because of that one famous scene?
Mostly. So part of the reason I put number 50 is... One, it's another one of the really famous Spider-Man comics. And yeah, that scene is the biggest part of that. The cover is also really famous. Remember last time I was talking about how Romita is especially good at covers, more so than Ditko. And then I also just wanted to give it like a little bit of time to breathe for us to feel like he and Gwen are actually like building towards something. Because it's just, I know we hopped around a lot and it still was a lot of reading. So I thought it was a good way of doing that. Also giving us a little glimpse of the Kingpin.
Yeah.
Which is nice and timely since he's potentially showing up in this week's episode of Hawkeye. Rumors, at least.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Right. So with issue 50, you do kind of get the Mary Jane, Gwen Stacy dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I enjoy, number 50 is so good.
It is good.
Because Peter is just really conflicted about being Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it very interesting that when he quit being Spider-Man, he actually got a lot happier.
Right.
Which made me kind of sad.
I know. That's the thing. Like, you're getting it. Like, that's what makes this character so fascinating. And that's what Kyle and I have been kind of talking around when it comes to the MCU version. Because it's like this, like, so Spider-Man 2 adapted this, obviously, which is probably how you're familiar with that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a pretty good job of showing that. Although here, I think it's even better done because he's like, he's wrestling with, one, am I even doing this for the right reasons? Mm-hmm. Like, am I doing this just because I am what J. Jonah Jameson says? Like, I'm sort of a glory hound and I just like the thrill of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's wrestling with that. But then, yeah, it's this like, He's never going to be happy as Spider-Man because of just the burden of it, which I think in some ways unintentionally, I was reading a bit that Romita wrote about these issues, and he was saying that what's kind of crazy is they didn't, reading them back, it looks like they were foreshadowing things, but it was totally kind of by accident. Like, the story just kind of told itself, but you get these lines in like 50 and in 90 that almost, like, as you know what's going to ultimately happen with him and Gwen,
mm-hmm.
like, almost, it like, aches a little bit because you see him being like, I know that this is going to end poorly if I keep being Spider-Man, but I can't not be Spider-Man because I feel this, like, crushing sense of obligation and responsibility. And so he really is in, like, this sort of terrible position, and that is kind of that is what makes Spider-Man Spider-Man.
Well, and you can see that he's never forgiven himself for what happened to Uncle Ben.
Right.
What you see in his actions as Spider-Man are just ways of kind of trying to rectify himself.
Right.
And that's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite pieces of art out of this batch of comics, though, is when he gets the suit back.
Uh-huh.
And you just see the Spider-Man feet that are clearly on J. Jonah Jameson's desk.
Uh-huh.
And J. Jonah Jameson walks in and is all shocked. I just love the way that that's set up.
Mm-hmm. No, I like that. I remember noting that too. That's a good call out. Yeah, I really like the way that Romita frames scenes.
And also, oh my God, Flash gets drafted.
Oh, yeah. That's actually a huge thread that we didn't really get to explore here. But yeah, he comes back from Vietnam, not the same person. Like, they're really trying to explore, like, another, some of the optional issues that we'll get to later is when they get into those drug stories that we talked about in our very first episode.
You mean when Harry loses his mind on LSD?
Yes, but that happens. There's one where it's even more pronounced, and it's actually a really satisfying issue because Peter, as Peter, finds the drug dealers and, like, beats them. which is, because it's like Harry at the time is like really struggling, and it's like Peter just takes all of his anger out. But there's some other stuff from those issues that I'll briefly cover once we get there. But let's jump to number 59, which I put in mostly because it is Peter and Gwen's first kiss. So in some ways, kind of the start of them actually dating.
Right.
But it also gives us some really good MJ time because she's doing her time as a go-go dancer.
Is this the one where with the brainwasher?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, boy. Okay. So while we're skipping around, I missed some things. Why was Peter, did he go missing?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So it's actually like a fairly long arc here, like longer than these normally were at this time. He is basically, somehow he gets amnesia and Doc Ock convinces him that he's actually a villain. And so he like works with Doc Ock as a villain for like several issues. And during that whole time, obviously no way seeing Peter because he doesn't know who he is. And so Peter is declared a missing person. Spider-Man's declared a villain, and that's why whenever we meet back up with him, he's like he's having to explain both where he was and try to kind of defend what Spider-Man was doing.
Got it.
Which is why like Gwen is so excited to see him, and that's why Captain Stacy is involved here, who we haven't missed a ton on Captain Stacy jumping around. I think he was just introduced an issue or two ago, but he's kind of on the case trying to figure out who Spider-Man is because he was trying to hunt him down. And through that, as we see, he starts to get closer than anybody else to actually figuring out Peter's secret.
I wish that the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies had done a better job of amplifying MJ's acting career.
Uh-huh.
Because I guess I just don't find Kirsten Dunst to be a very compelling MJ. And I know that we've probably said that several ways now, but
yeah, and which I don't blame her for necessarily. I feel like that she wasn't given a great role because Kirsten Dunst. Think about this: one of your favorite movies is Elizabethtown,
mm-hmm.
And can't you imagine that version of MJ? Like she's very kind of quirky and funny and intriguing, but instead we get a very kind of like whiny version of the character that's like always upset about something, it seems.
Okay, no, but listen to this. If this character that I've been reading this past week were put into modern day times,
right,
she'd be an Instagram influencer.
Oh, for sure. That's so true. Especially as we get to the like the wedding episode and like number 300.
Right. And so I mean
or the wedding issue, sorry.
You can't put 2021 standards on something created from the mid-2000s, but that's the kind of energy I'm telling you that she's missing, where it's very confident and rowdy.
Yeah. And fun, and like funny.
Yeah. And quirky and weird, but so are those people on the internet.
Right.
And it's just something that is missing.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing. I really like the version of MJ we see here. We also, I wanted us to get to meet Captain Stacy a little bit more. What did you think about the first kiss with Gwen in front of her dad and her dad being like weirdly into it?
Is that it, this issue?
It is this issue.
I'm trying to find it. Are you sure?
Yeah, it's at the very beginning.
Okay, that's right. It was weird.
Yeah. There's also another scene that I'll touch on in those optional issues where Norman Osborn, just as Norman Osborn, he's not the Green Goblin at that point, but at that point, Harry and MJ are dating, which we'll talk about in a second. And Harry brings him to his show, or to her show. And afterwards, he's like, so what'd you think? And Norman's like, well, hey, if I were 20 years younger. And it's like,
ugh. Whoa! No, that's the, no, it's so bizarre. And even Peter's like, isn't this kind of weird? And her dad's like, what does he say? He calls it, he's like, even an old war horse like myself
right.
likes watching my daughter kiss. I'm like, get a life. You are so weird.
Yeah, I thought that you would get a kick out of that. So how are you, as we're kind of checking in at this point then, we've talked about Mary Jane. How are you feeling? We get a little bit of Gwen time. How are you feeling about that relationship and about Gwen as a character?
I mean, Gwen is very sweet and earnest, and I think she cares about Peter.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that I do like, I can't remember if they focus on this here, but one of these issues from this era, they really highlight that she is also a science major.
I don't think she's as memorable as MJ.
Yeah. No, I think that's generally the consensus. So I think you're on the right path there. I think people think that Gwen is remembered really only because of her death.
Which is a very tragic and beautiful scene,
mm-hmm.
but I agree with you.
Yeah.
Even in these, I know that we're jumping around based on the issues you've selected for us to read.
Right.
So even there are times when I'm wondering, am I missing part of this relationship because it just doesn't feel like there's anything there? I mean, they ride around on their motorcycles together and have fun and clearly some sort of chemistry, which I didn't even really understand until after she dies. Because
and he reflects.
Yes, because I... And maybe you can speak to that a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so I'll talk about that a little bit after issue 90 when we talk about those issues you missed. It is a very, it's kind of an on and off again thing because they have some different obstacles that they face as a couple. But you definitely get the sense that really from like issue 59 on, Peter is like hardcore in love with Gwen. And if they have issues and if they're apart, it's because of Spider-Man. And that's part of, like, I think the tragedy of 121 and 122 is, like, he, again, kind of saw it coming and they tried their best to, like, navigate it. But he is, like, you miss some of it, but they're very clearly in love, wanting to get married, like, foreseeing a future together. And I think that that is captured really well in the retrospective there, and then also in his kind of doubts on the wedding day with MJ
mm-hmm.
that we'll talk about.
Before that happens, Captain Stacy dies.
Yeah, which is why we included number 90 here, because that's one of the bigger obstacles that they face in the relationship there. It gives us a little bit more Gwen time as well, but... Yeah, the issues you didn't see here are the fallout of that, where Gwen blames Spider-Man for the death and really like has a vendetta against him and winds up ultimately leaving the country and going to live in London with family. And that's what I mean whenever I say it was almost on and off again, where she and Peter are still in love. Peter actually travels over to London to try to see her and win her back. But whenever he's over there, he winds up classically like facing a situation where Spider-Man's needed. And once he becomes Spider-Man, he realizes, well, now there's no way I could explain that Spider-Man and Peter Parker just happen to be in the same place going like where neither of them really belong. And so he winds up just having to get back on a plane and never even see Gwen.
Wow.
While he's there.
That was in this batch that I missed, or is that
something? No, you didn't. That's in the, that wasn't in the optional reading. That's just kind of what's happening behind the scenes of all this.
Oh man, that's really compelling.
It is.
Well, to your point and kind of what I was saying earlier, based on how MJ reacts to Spider-Man and what Gwen Stacy feels about him, it would have never worked with Peter.
Right.
If he had just completely let go of being Spider-Man, which
mm-hmm.
I wish he could understand that that's an option.
Yeah.
Because it did seem like he was a lot happier, but we're not here to talk about that.
Right.
I think if that, he had just done that and chosen Gwen Stacy, that would have been a happy life. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he could have had a relationship with Gwen Stacy and continued to be Spider-Man.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I think that's true. And that's explored in various kind of like alternate universe Spider-Mans that we've gotten. But yeah, what did you think about the Captain Stacy death scene itself? I always find that to be pretty moving as far as old comics go.
So I don't actually blame Spider-Man for Captain Stacy's death.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I kind of do, I think. I mean, not he obviously didn't intend it, but he...
I blame Dr. Octopus for his death.
Well, sure, but Peter does... I mean, he sprays Doc Ock's tentacles with that chemical that makes them go wild. And I do think this kind of plays into Peter being young still, mm-hmm. where, like, he didn't consider the possibility that that would create sort of this chaos machine with, you know, with no way to kind of tell what the consequence, I mean, and again, I don't know that he should have foreseen that, but I do think that that's part of the tragedy of this is that he knows now, like, had I not come up with that way to try to beat Doc Ock, maybe Doc Ock would still be on the loose, but like Captain Stacy probably wouldn't be dead.
But you could say that about anyone, because there were a lot of innocent bystanders, right. And they're all watching this fight that's happening on top of this building, and
right.
there's got to... I find this to be a very fun conversation, because I feel like you and I have kind of switched roles here, because I usually blame superheroes for innocent deaths.
That's true.
But in this circumstance, I think part of me was... pretty impressed with Peter with coming up with the solution to kill Doc Ock. Uh-huh. And I really liked that fight scene because he kind of just ended up fighting himself.
Right.
I was like, oh, that's really cool. And then, of course, there wasn't a lot of forethought into what could happen if this person exploded. But I don't know. I just feel like...
Well, there's clearly, like, it's also sort of like what Kyle and I talked about with The Amazing Spider-Man 2 and Gwen's death there, she kind of puts her, like, intentionally puts herself at risk. Like, she knows that it's a risk, and she puts herself there, and it makes it feel, in some ways, like, it gives the character more agency, and they're less just, like, a tragic instance of collateral damage, and it's more a sacrifice that they chose to make, which I think is more powerful. And I think Captain Stacy here, he clearly... It's not like he just was caught beneath the rubble. Like, he makes the choice to get that kid out of the way.
Pink t-shirt child may be more responsible.
That's true. That kid, what was he even doing down there?
I know.
What an idiot.
And where are his parents? Why is there a villain fight happening in this town?
True.
And a toddler running around at the same time?
Yeah, that's his parents are the real villains here.
Robbie, this is not a black and white issue. There is a lot of gray area.
Right.
Anyway, so I didn't mean to say.
But did you find the kind of final scene there where Stacy reveals that he knew Spider-Man's identity all along?
Ooh, that was really, really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he calls him Peter,
mm-hmm.
and then dies.
Well, and tells him to take care of Gwen, which is like,
It's also the opposite of how the Amazing Spider-Man movies do that scene.
Yes, I'm so glad. I was going to say that. I'm so glad you caught that. What do you mean by that?
I mean that when Captain Stacy dies in the movies, he's like, stay away from my daughter.
Right.
But in this one, and I wonder why they did that.
Yeah. Everything in the Amazing Spider-Man movies is darker and angstier.
Mm.
And that's an example where it's like, because I honestly think in some ways it makes it even more sad here because he's like, no, like, just take care of her, you know, just like be good to her because I can't anymore. And it's like, and then Peter tries so hard and...
I think John Romita and I would get on well.
Yeah, I think so.
I know that this might be cheating, but... you know that I am not reading the optional material.
Right.
So would you like to fill me in on what I missed in the late 90s issues?
Yes. So the biggest thing there, and it actually worked out really well that those could be optional, because a lot of the beats that are hit there are almost recycled, like, beat for beat in 121. But it does add, it fleshes a lot of things out if you'd read them. That is actually when the Green Goblin returns in those issues, but he kind of returns and then Peter does away with him and then he comes back and you still get a kind of goblin coming back thing in 121. So I didn't think that that would be too confusing to miss. The bigger things to talk about in those issues are, one, that's the first time we see Harry get involved with drugs. And it's the first time we see Harry really kind of becoming an unstable person, which is a big part of that character really for the rest of his existence in Spider-Man comics. Is he's like always, it's really sad because he's all, like, people won't comment all the time like, look, he's got everything he wants. He's got a rich dad. He's never been told no. But like, why is he at some point someone says like, I wish I knew why he was so weak, because he like falls back on drugs. And it's like, well, like, yeah, but his dad is not, like, it doesn't, at some point it doesn't matter how much money he has, you know, like, his dad has clearly, aside from him being a supervillain, just, like, not given him any level of affection.
I do feel like when bad things happen to rich people or people with money or a cushioned life,
mm-hmm.
It's very easy for people on the other side of things to be like, well, I don't get it. He's rich.
Right.
Which, this is coming from a person that does not have a lot of money. So
right.
I feel like I can say that. But it's all relative, right?
Yeah, it's all relative.
So, you know, whereas you, because, I don't know, sometimes money can make your problems worse.
Well, and one of the things that those issues do really well is, and again, this was like that when we talked about the comics code kind of breaking down, and these issues are really famous largely for that. But Stan Lee does this great job of showing, it's like Spider-Man saves this guy. He's a black guy that's like about to jump from the top of a building because he's tripping, and like he jumps off and Spider-Man catches him, and they have this whole conversation about the drug epidemic. And you start to, like, there are even conversations that they have where Norman Osborn, who at this point is just kind of like a stand-in for like a rich guy, is talking with Robbie Robertson's son, who is very much like kind of a political radical and is like talking about how drugs are basically like ripping through the African-American community. And they have this debate where he's basically like, you guys think that this is like a poor person problem and a black person problem. And Norman Osborn's basically like, one, he's not like a total, he's not like evil there. I think he's supposed to be the mouthpiece for the like, well, look, like, I'm, you know, what am I supposed to do about it? Like, how do I fix it? And the genius of the story is by the end, it's Harry mm-hmm. who's caught in it. And it's this really, I think, great look at, like, for a comic, a bunch of socioeconomic issues that you wouldn't expect to come up. And so for that reason, I think it's really interesting. And I think you probably would have enjoyed that. But a lot of that, as you can probably tell, is not furthering
right.
the Peter romance stuff.
I will say, one thing that I've enjoyed about reading through comics for the first time is the ability to dive into these really heavy issues that are going on in our world in a way that feels digestible and kind mm-hmm. of safe to start forming an understanding around.
Right. I mean, I like, this was very formative reading for me, you know. The two things that it does do romantically that I want to touch on that are really important, actually. One, we get the conclusion of Gwen being in London. Like, this ends with basically the way that Spider-Man beats the Green Goblin is he shows him Harry kind of struggling in this hospital bed, and that like snaps him back to Norman Osborn and his amnesia kicks back in.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's sort of now Spider-Man's really nervous because he's like, can it just flip on at any time? So after that, the whole Goblin saga, Gwen shows back up and it ends with them kind of re-embracing, and she decides that she can be with Peter and he decides that he can be with her, and so it ends on that note. The other thing that these issues do that I think will probably be really helpful for you as we get into 121 and 122 is Mary Jane here is like really cruel to Harry. And that's important because like MJ takes the whole like I'm no one's woman thing maybe a tad further than she has to. Like on the one hand, Harry's trying to be like, you're my gal. And she's like, no, I'm like my own person. I'm not anyone's gal. But at the same time, she goes beyond that and like intentionally flirts up Peter in front of Harry just to kind of like
this man that's clearly struggling with addiction.
Right. Which drives him to like take more drugs. And so it's this like not that it's her fault, but I say that to say like at that point she and Harry were kind of dating, and that's when she gets to a level where Peter is like, okay, you are like sort of toxic.
Mm.
Like you like hurt our good friend for seemingly like no reason. And so that's why whenever we get to that final scene in 122 where Peter is being like really mean to her,
mm-hmm.
but you kind of see why, because he's like, I don't need you around right now.
Right. Well, and sometimes you just have to be very direct when someone's flirting with you.
Right.
When you know they're doing it to spite someone else.
Right.
So I can understand that. I also understand her wanting to be her own person.
Oh, but for sure.
I think she is doing it in a way that is just intentionally trying to be mean. What I liked about 121, because we mm-hmm. can't, we have to like take a moment for this.
Sure.
Is how it begins with the cover with all these people in Peter's life.
Yes.
And it's like, who's going to die? And the entire time, I think it's going to be Harry because
wow.
he's the one that's tripping balls.
Right.
And clearly out of his mind, clearly the one that you would expect to be like going down this road
mm-hmm.
that has no happy ending.
Right.
That's not what happens.
Yeah, but you're right. It is clearly sort of, I never thought about it that way.
It was like a bait and switch.
Yeah, I think I never got the experience you got because I think I knew that Gwen Stacy died before I ever actually read this issue, just as someone that was sort of like steeped in Spider-Man lore. But yeah, you're right. That is kind of a nice bait and switch. There are so many things to talk about on with this comic, and I can't talk about all of them. But one, there's a kind of whole mythology that's built up just around this issue and how it came about. And Stan Lee said that, so you'll note, I think this is the first non-Stan Lee issue that we read in this batch, actually, or period. It's written by Jerry Conway, who was the one that kind of took the torch from Stan and also wrote a bunch of classic tales. But
and I felt that shift. And what I mean by that is these comics get trippier especially when they start getting into the psychedelics.
Right.
I unabashedly love uh-huh. the trippiness of it, but it does get less kooky.
It's more melodrama.
And this is the point where I was mentioning earlier where I kind of missed what I didn't realize is that Stan's goofiness in his writing
mm-hmm.
tempered the darkness that he was dealing with.
Right.
So it is different. I'm not saying it's bad or worse. It's
right.
just something that I felt shift.
It's clearly just heavier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Stan maintains that, or he did for a while. I think he eventually relented on this. You remember how I said that Stan was kind of, he would notoriously contradict himself depending on like when he was telling the story. And one of the things that he said for a while after this issue came out is that he had basically told them not to do this and that they killed Gwen Stacy against his wishes. Now, he was like editor-in-chief at that point, and all the writers have been like, that's obviously not what happened. Like, we would not have put out a comic.
Okay, I felt like she didn't have to die, though. Why do you think they killed her?
So I've read some stuff from Jerry Conway where he just didn't think it was an interesting character, and he thought the way to make it more interesting was by adding this kind of tragedy, which sort of fits with what you were saying earlier. Like, I think he actually thought MJ was the much better character and that this was a way of adding drama to Spider-Man's history, like he needed that, but two, setting the stage for MJ to be more of the clear focus. And because I think he just felt like with all the kind of back and forth, some of which you missed, and like the Captain Stacy stuff, I think he kind of felt like Gwen had been played out.
Mm.
And that it needs something like almost like a George R. R. Martin thing. Like,
I was thinking George R. R. Martin when you said that. And right. It actually really frustrates me that people or creators choose to kill off a character for drama. It yeah. seems like very low hanging fruit.
It can be
it's
cheap.
Like Michael Scott's improv class right. where he just always has a gun.
Right.
You're like, okay, I get it.
No, for sure. Although this one did, you know, has wound up being legendary. People actually, by the way, consider this to be the end of the quote unquote silver age of comics. So it's a very significant moment. And just so for those that don't know, the golden age is like the original, like 30s Superman, Batman, Captain America stuff in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
The Silver Age is what started with Fantastic Four and The Amazing Spider-Man. And then the Bronze Age is the like 70s, 80s stuff that kind of comes after this. And so it's like from here on, like that shift you're talking about whenever Lee leaves and things start to get kind of grittier, that's when we get into that like quote unquote Bronze Age
mm-hmm.
territory. One of the other things that I wanted to bring up is the actual scene where Gwen falls off the bridge and he shoots the strand down. Do you notice anything there in terms of the sound effects that we see?
The snap?
Yes.
I know that from the Amazing Spider-Man movie.
Yes. However, it's kind of different there because I think you're supposed to understand she like hits the ground briefly and bounces off.
I feel like you and I always, maybe it's because you knew what happened, but you always told me her neck broke.
So that's the other thing that's really fun. Like I talked about the kind of Stan Lee piece of this. The other piece is I've read interviews and Romita. So this was a joint project from John Romita and Gil Kane, which you'll kind of recognize because the art shifts slightly from panel to panel or from page to page at least. And between them and Jerry Conway, none of them can remember whose idea it was to insert the snap.
What?
And so none of them can remember why it's there and what it was supposed to symbolize.
I mean, clearly her neck broke and that's how she died.
Right, but then the goblin in here is like, she died before she ever hit the water. It's such a long fall. But yeah, as it goes on...
Why would she die in the middle of the air?
I mean, I guess. I don't know. That's what the goblin says.
You know one thing I appreciate about the 1950s and 60s?
Mm-hmm.
You know that I am a delicate person.
Uh-huh.
And there are times when these characters, they're like, oh no, she got scared at night. She is shocked and unwell.
Right.
And that seems very foreign to us.
Right.
But it's actually something that I relate to in my personal life.
That's funny. You're actually, like, you can't take any shock.
This is also like an aside. I have recently become a member of the Austin Film Society,
mm-hmm.
which is a movie theater in town that I really love. I know we talk about Alamo Draft House a lot,
uh-huh.
but this place is really cool, especially if you like old movies. So I went to go see the movie Vertigo by Alfred Hitchcock earlier this week. And one thing, and this is kind of playing out in the same era
right.
of time, whenever a character is feeling remotely unwell, they're like, drink this whole glass of brandy.
Right.
And I just think that's such a ridiculous solution to your problems.
Yeah,
but they
true.
Talk about it like it's medicine.
Right.
So anyway, that's what it's like to be shocked in the 1950s in the year 2021.
Yeah, apparently. The snap there has wound up, I think, being one of the more memorable moments of this because not that it's in any way Spider-Man's fault, but I think he has to live with the fact that his web that was meant to save her, the force of that is actually what snaps her neck and kills her.
Mm-hmm.
And you can separate that out and be like, well, what else was he supposed to do? That's one of the reasons, by the way, why I think the Raimi film, they reimagine that by him diving off and grabbing MJ
mm-hmm.
instead of like webbing her.
Right.
But still, like, even though logically, like, well, he did everything he could, it adds like such another level of despair to it that like it's him that did it. And then he goes down thinking he saved her.
But what's funny about that, something I don't even think the creators intended, mm-hmm. is that we know more than he does.
Right.
Because yeah. the goblin is like, she's already dead. And he's like, yeah. I couldn't save her. But we're reading the sound effects and
yeah.
we're like, oh, we know though what happened.
And that, yeah. And I think he like reflects on it more as he goes. And of course, being like the guilt-ridden character that he is, internalizes it.
But what's so twisted about it is that the Green Goblin is Norman Osborn.
Right.
So, again, going back into where this is just more nuanced as these issues move forward,
mm-hmm.
it's not just a bad guy. It's Harry's dad.
Right.
And what I think I love about 121 and 122 together is that all of issue 122 is giving this character room to mourn.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of going back and thinking about Gwen,
right.
retribution.
Right. Yeah, he's trying to get revenge.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think like a couple scenes that always strike me as particularly poignant. One, they recreated this, by the way, perfectly in The Amazing Spider-Man 2, the scene I'm about to talk about, where he jumps down and he's very like he's even as he's on his way down, like, well, look at me, Spider-Man. No one else could have made that save, but I did. And he goes down and he's like, hey, Gwendy, like, wake up. Like, I saved you. And the moment of him realizing, like, having to go from that, like, kind of classic Spider-Man, like, nick of time, I did it thing to, like, I'm holding my dead girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
like, is so rough. And then in 122, at the beginning, when he's, like, won't let anybody touch her.
It's super dark.
It's like,
he's literally just flying around town holding a corpse.
But it's like he's trying, he can't, because once it gets, then it becomes real, right? Like he knows that she's gone, but he's still trying to hold on to, like he has that line, like maybe it can still like be the way that it was. And like, he's clearly like grasping because he's like on the edge of insanity.
Mm-hmm.
Because of what he just watched happen. Because again, he's like 20 here, you know, like,
right.
If that, like, he's like 19 and he just had to watch this, like the middle-aged father of his best friend throw his girlfriend off a bridge and then watch her die. Like, it's such a traumatic thing that, and again, like nothing like this happened in comics, by the way. Like, I have to say, like, the reason that's considered to be the end of the Silver Age is like, yes, you had like the death of Uncle Ben, but you never had anything like this happen to a main recurring character and in this like vicious of a way. It was like truly shocking at the time.
Mm-hmm. Man, and then not to even, well, I'm going to show you this panel.
Yeah.
I love this. What I'm showing Robbie is the scene where it's all of the best memories with Gwen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and what I love about it is that we don't get pages like this very often in this era,
right.
where they're full page.
Mm-hmm.
And I love a full page spread, I'm realizing.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I think some of those Romita layouts were sort of ahead of their time.
Mm-hmm. Even if you move to the next one where he is fighting cops, which I don't know if I recommend, but like the way that Spider-Man's foot like comes out of the frame.
Yeah.
There's just some moments like that that are done with the art that I just think,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, why did it take you guys so long to branch out of these little squares? But
yeah, they start, the squares start to expand and like be a little bit less regular, which is nice. I just saw you scrolling. Also, whenever he goes back and Harry obviously doesn't know what happened yet,
mm-hmm.
and he's so frustrated because Harry's still like out of his mind, and Harry's like begging him not to leave, and Peter's like,
oh, I know. It was crushing.
But you know Peter's also, which is not fair, like, can't help but associate Harry with Norman at that point.
Right. Well, yeah, there's just, like, a lot of bad things going on with this crew. And there's a lot we could talk about there with the Green Goblin.
Well, because this is actually the end of, like, Norman Osborn was fully dead and out of the universe for decades. Like, they brought him back at, like, the tail end of the 90s, but, like, for, like, 30 years, he was gone.
But then he dies, like, because his jetpack hits him and, like, impales right. him, which is just crazy.
Well, it's like and the also, end of the Raimi film.
There's also so much death going on in Peter's life right now. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Like, if I had seen my girlfriend die, and then the next instance, the guy that's killing her
mm-hmm.
also dies. And I think what they did well about that, because I would have felt the exact same way, is when Spider-Man's like, I thought this would make me feel really good, but I feel right. so empty because Norman Osborn's dead. And I felt that way too. Like, I always think about, you know, you think that when the bad guy dies, you're going to feel good, mm-hmm. but that's not actually true.
Yeah.
Someone still died, whether or not you thought they, you know, you felt they were good or not.
One, especially because Norman is like at this, and I think the Norman Osborn character gets a little bit muddied whenever they bring him back, even though I like some of the stuff that they did in the 2000s. I think, like, what you talked about at the end of our last Green Goblin episode, it is kind of tragic because at the end of that last issue, you're like, okay, like, Norman is like, he's going to get his life back. Like, and he gets to, like, be with his son, and this is kind of a second chance for him. And so to see him go down this road and wind up killing himself, essentially, in an effort to murder Spider-Man, you're like, that isn't, like, that doesn't make you feel like, yeah.
I know. It makes you sit and feel kind of sad for a second. I did right. not expect, when I signed up to read all these comic books with you, that I would be dealing with issues this heavy.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Especially these early ones.
Right. Well, and then it ends with him being such an mean person to Mary Jane, who's yeah. also mourning.
Right. But again, that's why I gave you that fill-in, because Peter's got in the background the fact that Mary Jane, like, she set off a lot of this, like, drug stuff with Harry. She's like, she would always sort of, in his mind, like, was an instigator in, like, creating drama and trying to get between him and Gwen. And he's just like, I think in this moment, in so much grief, that he lashes out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, but it, I mean, it's very cruel. And he comments on that, like, in later comics and recognizes that. But I love, this is one of my favorite endings of any Spider-Man comic. Like, the her hovering in the doorway and then the just, like, shutting of the door. And, like, because it's such a moment for Mary Jane, because up until now, she has always been the, like, I don't want things to get too heavy. I can't be bothered with this. I'm just going to do whatever I want. And so it would be kind of characteristic of her to be like, you know what? I am going to, like, I'm going to get out of here and let you deal with all this. And the fact that she shuts the door and decides to, like, sit with Peter in that, I think is really, really moving. A really moving part of a really moving issue, I think.
Well, and then to that point, you jump us quite ahead to a wedding issue, which I want to spend a little bit of time here, because yeah. I have never met two people that should not get married in my life. This entire issue, I was reading it and then audibly turning the page going, nope, nope, nope.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's funny. It's kind of another bait and switch, because you think it's heading towards them breaking it off the whole time. Like, there are so many signs. And then,
also, I know that weddings are different now than they used to be, but this is all coming together very quickly.
Yeah, like 3 days.
She's like, oh, we need to, like, shoot, you know, we need to, like, tell people this is happening.
Right.
Like, surely at this time they still had invitations, but right. whatever.
Well, yeah, they're impetuous. I one thing I do want to say.
Are you going to talk about how Peter is mega hot in this one?
No, but I want to hear you talk about how Peter is mega hot. Look at this. Yeah, yeah.
So James Dean.
80s Peter was pretty hot. There are some other comics I could point you to where he's got some, like, scruff. one thing I wanted to just clue you in on that we missed in some 80s issues not too long before this, you had said earlier that Mary Jane didn't know Peter was Spider-Man whenever she's first introduced and they're out with the Rhino and stuff. That was later retconned. And in the 80s, we find out that MJ, when she was living with her aunt near May Parker's house, actually, like, really early on, sees Spider-Man crawling out of the window of Aunt May's house and puts two and two together, which is sort of what they do in Spider-Man Far From Home when Zendaya puts it together.
Right.
And so it wind, and in doing that, there was another issue that I thought about having us read, but we just ran out of space. But we actually get this whole backstory to MJ and find out that the kind of party girl thing has always been a front. And like we find out about her having an abusive father and the fact that she was basically kind of like sort of like Enneagram 7 style, maybe, mm-hmm. like running from any feelings of like actual grief, even though she, those feelings were warranted by being like, I'm the life of the party. I'm just like gonna like repress everything.
Wow.
And so the character, by the time we've met back up with her, you don't get that here in this issue or in 300, but that is kind of the background that like the character has taken on some new dimension ahead of them getting married.
Well, and she's also got a very flourishing career at this point.
Yeah. That apartment, man.
And what's a dynamic that I wasn't expecting is Peter's inferiority from,
yeah,
like a financial standpoint.
We got a real Kacey Musgraves breadwinner situation.
Totally. But from his end, not hers.
Right, right.
But also, she's got some men in her life that,
right,
clearly don't think very highly of Peter.
Right.
Which I thought was kind of funny.
But there was a moment there where they're like at this party and they're like, look how great this is. Why do you want to like turn this in for like dirty rags and dishes? And I was like, they're not wrong. I mean, it seems pretty cool. She's got a pretty good thing going.
Bright red Ferrari.
Right. That he just gave to her.
So this is in the 80s.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because the art looks very dated. This looks like something that would have come out of the Stan Lee era.
Yeah, it kind of stalls for a bit. John Romita Jr. had done the art before this, and it was very different from the John Romita Jr. art that we got in Eternals and that we'll see in the Spider-Man issues next time. It was much more in keeping with what his dad did, but it really did kind of stick to like a some version of what Romita set for a while until Todd McFarlane comes on board in Amazing Spider-Man number 300 that we'll talk about here in just a second.
Man, but even the way Peter is still not over Gwen,
mm-hmm.
days before this, I'm like, you need to deal with this.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mary Jane has these, you know, some South of France connect.
Cool. I want that.
I know, me too.
Yeah, no, it's, but I kind of like it. It makes for like a fun final reveal. And by the way, one of the main reasons that we had to read this, other than it being a huge moment in the character story, is we are going to revisit some of these exact panels in one of the stories we're reading next time, the final one, which is called One Moment in Time, which is a part of a very controversial Spider-Man run, where a lot of this is both revisited and sort of undone.
You know what else is interesting about this wedding issue is I have not seen these characters drink until now.
Yeah. Well, there is like I think it was unofficial and kind of became official at one point, rule that Peter Parker can never be shown consuming alcohol. It's like some like Marvel standing rule where that character in particular. And I think that there were times early on where you see him drinking a glass of wine or champagne or something. But generally, they have some weird like morality clause where I've read stuff with like comedians that have been hired to write single issues of Spider-Man. And they would turn in like a scene where he's like having a beer with friends. And Marvel editorial comes back and is like, no, you can't. Like Spider-Man doesn't drink.
man, crazy. And then the other thing I liked about that annual is his nightmare where all the villains come back for his wedding right. and he gets married as Spider-Man.
Uh-huh.
It's really good.
And I like the dialogue there always cracks me up because it's like Doc Ock is there and he's like, this is insane. And then Captain America's like, it's the American way. And then Hobgoblin's like, die.
So funny. So the reason you put this last issue in here is because Venom is going to potentially show up in the movie.
Yeah, that and...
Do you think it's going to be Tom Hardy?
If he shows up, I think it'll be Tom Hardy because of the stinger from the last one, from the last Venom movie. I put it in here partially for that reason, partially because it gives you a really good snapshot of Peter and Mary Jane's married life.
We talked about this briefly today. I hate this artwork, and I hate how horny these writers are for MJ.
Yeah, it's weird.
It is such a turn, and it made me feel icky.
Yeah, she's like, Peter's feeling depressed. Time to take my shirt off.
I know. I'm like, that's not the solution to all your problems.
Yeah, and she kind of takes a step back as a character in this issue.
They also aged her. And I don't know if it's because they gave her this kind of Jessica Rabbit sexy uh-huh. look. Like, her hair is very much...
Very 80s.
Very 80s. We talked about this earlier today, not on here, but I don't like how this artist draws faces.
Yeah, so we have to say, I mean, people that are familiar with comics will know this. Todd McFarlane is one of the biggest names in comics, really, period, but especially in this era. I mean, he really put his stamp on the character. And I will say, I enjoy Todd McFarlane's version of Spider-Man, like when he's in mask.
Mm-hmm.
I'm with you. I don't really like the way he draws Peter Parker or really any faces. It's very harsh. Like, the features are all, like, very accentuated and, like, magnified. And it's just, like, it's, like, so different from, like, the John Romita... like aesthetic that's so nice to look at.
And the way he draws Mary Jane's body is so twisted.
Right.
It's one of those things where it's just very gratuitous. Mm-hmm. I mean, just very pin up. And I mean, I'm all for, I mean, if you got it, flaunt it. But the way it's kind of exploited specifically for men and for Peter, it just uh-huh. made me want to, just rolling gross. My eyes. I was like, gosh, get a hold of yourselves.
It's gross, and it's interesting that it's the later comics that are almost more guilty of the objectification of women than the, like, 60s ones, where you would think it would be much more pronounced, although obviously not as gratuitous.
I will say, I'm saying a lot of things on this particular episode that could be construed as prudish, and I don't mean them to come off that way. I'm just finding myself generally annoyed with male writers.
Right. Well, so that aside, and then we'll end talking about kind of how this issue sets Spider-Man and MJ moving forward. But I do want to get your thoughts on the Venom character here and the black suit Spider-Man, because this mm-hmm. is, well, I guess you saw it briefly in the wedding issue, but
right.
These are the first times you've seen that in comics. So what are your thoughts on that whole element?
Well, it makes the Venom movies that have come out more recently make more sense.
Mm.
I actually, reading this issue, you know, I'm always coming to this from like a movie perspective.
Right.
The movies gave good context for this. And mm-hmm. whenever I was reading it, I was like, oh, that makes sense why they did it that way.
And Spider-Man 3 does adapt this scene almost exactly too, with Topher Grace in the church and the symbiote like dripping down.
We don't have to talk about that.
The issue there being the Topher Grace part.
Exactly. Well, and on that note, Tom Hardy is such a better casting.
Right.
Why would they choose Eric Forman from that 70s show to play this burly character?
Right.
It makes no sense.
Yeah, it's strange. I think that they were trying to do a, like, look, he's sort of like Peter Parker, but different.
Right.
But it doesn't. That's not who Venom is, you know, so it doesn't really work. This is also, like, I wish Venom had stayed here. Like, I don't really like Venom being an anti-hero. I don't need that version of him. I like him just being the, like, out on a vendetta against Spider-Man villain. And so that's why I sort of have a hard time with the Venom movies in general. Is I just don't think that the character makes a ton of sense when it's separated from the Spider-Man context.
Right. I'm with you there.
So as we're wrapping up here, the last thing, you know, we have MJ and Spider-Man. Well, Peter beats Venom and they come back and MJ sort of gives him his old costume back. And it's this kind of, I do like that it's this partner in crime, not partners in crime, partners in superheroics, I guess, thing where she's like kind of on his team and she's like, here, like take this costume. And it just, it I thought it was kind of a nice way of ending this walkthrough of like, we're leaving Peter married, relatively happy, in kind of a healthy spot. He and MJ are partners, even if she's like...
Well, and she signed up for this. And I think right. That's one thing I appreciate about her is that she's not trying to change him.
After the kind of Venom thing, which was clearly horrifying.
Right, clearly. I mean, yeah, there's some dramatic obstacles. But she knows that she's married a superhero and she's not complaining.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that can't be an easy life to agree to.
Right.
And she does it very well and she does it joyfully.
Mm-hmm.
And I really admire the character that's Mary Jane because who she's loving in the life she has said yes to are mm-hmm. very challenging and she does it with grace.
Wow. Well said.
Thanks.
Well, that concludes our walk through the Spider-Man history as corresponding to the films we have now. I really think we've covered almost everything that we could cover from The Amazing Spider-Man, at least. Not the film, the series. And now, as I said, it's time for No Way Home, which means a new movie, but also one more batch of comics to read.
And Doctor Strange.
So, like I said, if you have had the chance to read these other issues and listen to this episode, go ahead and read those next comics if you can before the movie, because they go fairly quickly. They're a lot newer, and I think you'll enjoy them, even if you just have some kind of scenes baked in. Like, I'll say I think that the Happy Birthday arc is going to be one that I expect them to pull from a lot. I think that parts of the Sensational Spider-Man issue are just really great, and it's also Matt Fraction, Candace.
Ooh, no way.
Yeah,
so we're wrote Spider-Man.
It's a one issue, but it's become a legendary one-off that he wrote.
Of course. You know I'm just like so into his whole deal now.
So that's a really fun like look at Peter when he's been unmasked and he's on the run. And he and MJ are having to kind of deal with that together.
Oh, that sounds important based on how I know the last movie ended.
Right. And so that, I think those will both be kind of big. And then the final one is that one moment in time, which in general you're going to see is not going to be applicable to the movie. But there is one scene in particular that, based on the trailer, is pulled directly into the movie. So a lot of fun stuff.
Ooh, I can't wait.
Well, thank you guys, as always, for supporting. We hope that you're excited for the new movie and that you feel like you've gotten a good blend of Spidey history along the way. Happy reading, and we will see you next time for the final batch of our Spider-Man No Way Home Comics Corner episodes.
And if you're interested, let's talk romance in the Slack.
Ooh, very true. A lot to talk about this week.
All right, we'll see you there.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.